I'm Nick Redfern. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Jerry. Thank you.
It's a nice day, summer and hot, but of course we're talking about New Mexico here in Roswell, and that time that crash happened, it was a pretty hot day too.
That's right, yeah.
You just got back from a vacation, I understand, and got to lay around on the beach.
Yeah, me and my wife went to Playa del Carmen, and I think we chose the right week with the storms I've been having recently, which literally kicked in just a week or so after we left, so I think we timed it right.
And let's get into this book a little bit. This is certainly a new theory, a new take. I've never heard this before at all. Your thesis or hypothesis or...
Yeah. Actually, aspects of the story have been floating around for a while, as I'll explain to you later, but the general thesis in terms of putting it out there, you know, at a large scale, I agree with you, hasn't been seen before. And basically, as you know, and as I'm sure all your listeners will know, that the Roswell event of 1947 has generated a huge amount of controversy. One of the main reasons that the government has actually come up with four explanations for what happened. First, they stated it was a flying disc, as UFOs are called, back in the summer of 47. Then that was hastily changed to a weather balloon. Then in 1994, the Air Force said, well, no, it wasn't a weather balloon, but it was a Mogul balloon designed to monitor for Soviet atomic bomb tests. But people said, well, what about the bodies? And the Air Force said, well, there were no bodies on Mogul balloons, so there were no bodies. But then in 1997, they changed that stance and then said, well, okay, there was some evidence that bodies were recovered, but they're actually crash test dummies used in parachute experiments. And then when it was pointed out to the Air Force that these experiments didn't begin till 53, that it just created even more controversy. And of course, you know that up until now, the most favoured theory, if you like, has been that this continual changing the goalposts, if you like, of what happened and coming up with new theories on the part of the official world is designed to hide and just confuse the truth about the fact that an alien spaceship crashed, which is the general theory that's put forward as to why.
Now, in your book, you set forward a reason for the government to hide this fact, for sure, but it's not extraterrestrials.
Well, that's right. What happened was that I've been working as a freelance journalist for about 20 years, and one of the things that I guess that allows you to do is to have sort of free rein as to, you know, how you do your work and when you work. And so I've been fortunate enough to quite literally, you know, be able to travel on the road for years at a time, interviewing people and doing freelance work to support myself, you know, that perhaps a lot of other people wouldn't be able to do. And so what's basically happened is that over the last few years doing the research for this book, I've been able to travel around the United States interviewing and tracking down old-timers. And they told me a story that in many ways actually wasn't that different from the UFO theory. It was just the interpretation of what the materials and the bodies were that the people were seeing that was different. The theory they came up with is actually very similar in the sense they were talking about advanced aircraft crashing with unusual bodies having been found, with potentially more than one crash site, and with the government instigating a huge cover-up, but a cover-up of something of more down-to-earth proportions. And this is where this new theory comes in. And basically what happened was that between 1996 and 2004, or actually some of the interviews are still ongoing today, follow-up interviews, I interviewed a number of old-timers from the US intelligence community and from the military and government. And collectively, the story they told me was that an event occurred that had its origins within the Japanese military of the Second World War. And what happened was, it's a verifiable fact that in the closing stages of the war, the Japanese military was attacking the US mainland with something called Fugo balloons. And the Fugo balloons, that's F-U-G-O, they actually weren't that technically advanced. They were just a balloon-type device that had a bomb attached to them. And they were calibrated so that when they were carried across the Pacific winds from Japan, they would get lower and lower in the sky. And the plan was that they would actually reach land, if you like, over American soil and explode if people came across them. And they were more of like a psychological weapon than anything else, just to, you know, put people on edge.
Is there evidence that they actually used these balloons? I mean, did they actually make it to the mainland?
Oh, yes. More, They literally launched somewhere in the region about 10,000 balloons, which have around about 1,000 or so actually reached the US mainland. And there were a number of fatalities where people had found these balloons and tugged on the wires and got killed. And in addition to that, the US military had a project, actually two, Sunset and Firefly, one of which was designed when these balloons were seen, that the pilots, US military pilots, were ordered to shoot these things out of the sky. So in many ways, it was actually like a precursor to the UFO wave of 2 years later, with these aerial objects, circular shape, coming into US airspace and the military trying to confront them. And Fugo balloons, there are numerous files at the National Archives and books having been written about them. What's interesting, though, is that in the very, very closing stages of the war, the Japanese announced that the Fugo balloon raids were actually only a precursor for something more deadly. And what these were, apparently, were plans that the Japanese had to build very, very high-flying, high-altitude balloons, beneath which would be attached a pressurized gondola with four pilots in the balloons. And the plan was that when they were over US soil, they would release bacteriological warfare agents, depending on where the area that the balloon approached was, which largely was over just down to chance. And US newspapers, particularly from the West Coast and particularly Seattle, actually talk about these planned balloon raids. And what's interesting is that the balloons, because size, weight, oxygen, pressurization, etc., had to be kept to a premium for what was going to be a four-day flight across the Pacific, they actually trained four guys for the flight, the Japanese I mean, who were in the region about 5'1", 5'2" tall, purely to keep weight down in this gondola type structure that was being constructed. And of course this never happened because of the atomic bombing on Japan and then Japan's surrender. But when US forces went over to Japan at the end of the Second World War, not only did they find details of this huge balloon operation piloted by what quite literally would have been small men, they found that there was another planned operation as well, which was sort of very, very similar. And it would have, again, like a huge balloon array, but instead of launching just a normal payload into the sky, the balloon system would have attached to it a detachable glider aircraft, which again would be piloted. And the plan was for this to be again sent across from Japan, across the Pacific winds, across the Pacific, and carried very, very high. And the reason it was carried very, very high was to try and avoid the rudimentary radar systems that existed at that particular time. And then the plan was, when it reached US airspace, unlike the other balloons where there was no control over where they would land or crash, the pilot would be able to detach the aircraft from the huge balloon system and then direct it again, kamikaze style, to a city and release, or unleash if you like, bacteriological warfare agents. And once again, this was piloted by a crew specifically trained in Japan. Again, small guys, the Japanese race, they're not 6-footers, but they specifically trained even smaller guys, around about 5'1", 5'2", to pilot this aircraft. And the story that I got from the witnesses, the military people, the intelligence people, was that this device, and actually the crew and the personnel involved, were basically taken at the end of the war as war criminals, and were told they would be prosecuted if they didn't continue working on this project, because America wanted to see if it was actually a viable project, if an aircraft could be launched into the sky by balloon and be detached, if it was going to work or not. And the story I got was that this device was tested in the New Mexico desert and failed catastrophically, and from there the operation was cancelled because it was just seen as too unwieldy and too strange to work accurately every time. And so the follow-on from that was that the scenario that was presented to me was that the balloon debris came down at one site, the Brazel Ranch, and then the aircraft and the bodies, or at least four of the five bodies, came down at another location. And it was the recovery or the finding by members of the public of some of this material that forced the government to try and come up with a cover story. And when people started talking about this weird aircraft and this strange field of debris and quite literally little men, then that generated UFO rumors, which in later years the government expanded upon to hide the fact that they'd been given clemency, if you like, to Japanese war criminals and to allow them to secretly continue this work. It wasn't so much the crash that was hidden, it was the implications of the fact that, you know, they allowed these people to continue their work on U.S. soil.
So, according to your research, the Air Force, or the Army Air Force in 47 in Roswell, when they said that they had... the first news releases talked about a UFO, that might have been on purpose.
The story I got, the whole point of why the release was made as such, was that the Roswell people, ironically, this was flown reportedly from White Sands and crashed off range. And before the military at White Sands could get to the air or even knew where it had come down, they actually weren't sure where it had come down. They were just quite literally looking for the material evidence. Before they got a chance to recover it, the rancher Brazel had found it, and the press release was made. And so what actually happened was that the people at Roswell had made inquiries, and nobody wanted to own up to having lost anything because the people at Roswell weren't cleared to know about it, so there was a denial on everybody's part that anything was lost. Then the Roswell people said, well, is it possible that it's one of these UFOs that we've been seeing, or the flying discs that have been reported? And so they unilaterally put out the press release, we think we found a flying disc. Then, when they put the press release out, the White Sands people realised that Brazel found the last piece of evidence that they were looking for from the crash, and in a worst case scenario, the people at Roswell have now announced that they think it's a flying disc. And so that's why they came a clamp down with the weather balloon story, but ironically, it then led the government to realise that they could capitalise upon the UFO story to hide what really happened.
So these were Japanese prisoners of war.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends how you define prisoners of war. Not people locked up as such. It was very similar to the situation with, again, I mean, this is a verifiable fact. At the end of the Second World War, a lot of German scientists were brought over under the cover of something called Operation Paperclip. And this was primarily bringing over rocket scientists, aircraft scientists, purely or partly at least, to ensure that these people didn't fall into the hands of the Soviet Union, you know, with a burgeoning Cold War coming along, which makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, they were told, well, you know, you committed atrocities or you attacked the US or the UK or Europe, we can prosecute you as war criminals, or you can come and work for us. And again, Operation Paperclip is now a verifiable fact. Numerous books have been written about it, and quite literally thousands of pages of documents have been declassified talking about this secret transfer of German personnel from Nazi Germany, one of whom was Wernher von Braun.
Right, we're all familiar with him.
What a lot of people may not be familiar, though, is that, you know, he was responsible for building the V-2 rockets that Nazi Germany used to bomb London, but he was given clemency, if you like, to continue his work in the US after the war. And so the story is that a similar situation happened with the Japanese. There was a fear that if somebody else got to the Japanese first, such as the Russians, that advanced technology might fall into their hands. So it's a case of, you know, we offer these people the offer that they cannot turn down.
How many people do you think were involved in this project?
Well, it probably wouldn't have been a large number. We're actually talking about a trained crew and the scientific and aviation personnel that were involved in constructing the balloon system and the aircraft. So, you know, we may be only talking about a couple of dozen collectively in total.
Okay, four or five or six, some amount perished.
Yes, yeah, there's no doubt that according to the testimony at least that I've received, that all the crew perished. What happened was that the plan was, as I said, to launch this huge balloon array from the New Mexico desert from kind of like a standing framework, but it's in the same way that a normal balloon would be launched, with a payload beneath it. But the payload was a glider type device rigidly connected to this, what was quite literally a huge balloon system. And when it was launched into the sky, the plan was just to have the pilot detach the aircraft at a low level and then just get it back on the ground again. What went wrong was that because this balloon, the balloon array, was coated with aluminum, there were actually some thunderstorms, flash thunderstorms of the type, you know, that do occur in that particular area, going on at this particular time. And this thing was basically like a huge lightning conductor and got struck by lightning when it was in the sky. And what happened was that the lightning strike caused the aircraft beneath the balloon system to become partly detached, and it, with it catastrophically, with its nose spinning towards the ground. So the pilot was unable to successfully detach the aircraft from the balloon system because it had failed. And eventually the weight of the aircraft and the disaster actually caused the two come apart in midair, but not in the way that it was intended. It was intended for the pilot to detach the aircraft from the balloon system, but in actual fact it just basically broke away after this lightning strike. So the aircraft plummeted to the ground at one location with the bodies, and then the huge balloon system continued on and came down at the Brazel Ranch, or the Foster Ranch that was manned by Brazel. And of course the prime intent and motivation of the people involved in the project was to recover the aircraft and the bodies, because if anybody found the balloons, then they would know they'd found a huge balloon system, but the project wouldn't be compromised because there was no way for the people to know who found it, what the balloons were being used for. So the prime thing was recovering the aircraft and the bodies, which they did, and then it was a case of looking, well, where has the balloon debris landed? And so, unfortunately, you know, they sent aircraft up, but the size of the desert and being unsure of locations, etc., they just missed it. And, you know, you were thinking of ideal situation, the size of the New Mexico desert, that what would happen would be that, you know, it would just fall in a remote location and the military would eventually find it and no one would ever know. But the worst scenario that could happen actually happened, and it landed on the Foster Ranch.
Yeah, Nick Redfern, do you, you know, you got people telling you this story. Any paper trail? Did you find anything?
There's paper trail in the sense of the fact that these Japanese balloons and the balloon bombs were planned, that the Japanese had plans to launch these high-flying, high-altitude balloons. I've actually got paperwork confirming this from 45.
But no report.
One of the things that they all told me, now, I mean, I know that detractors will say that what I'm about to tell you now is the witnesses making it all too convenient, but what they told me was that because this was such a controversial operation, it actually wasn't known to the president and the government. It was actually, if you like, a military cabal doing it behind the scenes in almost like a black project situation. And so that when the operations failed and failed badly, to hide the paper trail, they literally destroyed everything. Now, of course, if it was a crashed UFO and alien bodies, then there's no way that material evidence would be destroyed, because it would be unique material, you know, that could be examined, and potentially we could uncover massive amounts of new technology from it. But their argument was that this was just balloons and glider materials and Japanese bodies, and there was no need to keep it when a decision was taken to cancel the operation. So, ironically, I guess in that respect, I would have found it more suspicious if they'd said, you know, there was a hangar somewhere that had shredded balloon debris and crashed gliders in it. It wouldn't actually make that sense.
I wonder what they did with the bodies.
They basically said they were destroyed, you know, in a mortuary or whatever. I mean, you know, again, if they were alien bodies, there would be every reason to keep them. If they were just human bodies that were used.
Well, it's a great read, the book, and we've kind of glossed over some of it, but there's lots of details in it. I want to ask you some other things about the background around this book. When first of all, you know, I've done investigative reports, and not every investigator you know, does the same thing, but I usually get something that triggers an idea and I follow it up to a dead end or not a dead end, follow a hunch or whatever you want to call it. When did you first get the idea that maybe this was a Japanese prisoner type operation?
Well, what happened was that the first inkling that I got from it personally came in 1996 when I did an interview with a guy who worked with the British government at the time, and he said that he knew aspects of this particular story, and the material that he related to was broadly in line with what I've just related to you. And as I said, this was 1996, but at the time this was sort of the first occasion I'd ever actually heard anything about this, and the only occasion. And so all I did was just sort of file it away and relegate it to one of those interesting stories no one else had ever mentioned to me, but I'll keep on file. Then in 1998, I had a book published in England called The FBI Files, which was a look at the Freedom of Information Act material that's been released by the FBI on the subject of UFOs. And so that book was published in 98, and it included a chapter on UFO sightings investigated by the FBI at the Oak Ridge installation in Tennessee. Then in 2001, I gave a lecture for one of the MUFON groups out in Los Angeles, California, and an elderly lady contacted me and said that she'd worked at Oak Ridge and could she speak to me after the lecture. And I naturally assumed that because she said she'd read my FBI files book, which included information on the place where she worked, that she wanted to tell me something about those investigations, that perhaps, you know, she'd even been the subject of some of those investigations or recalled the incidents. But in actual fact, what she wanted to tell me was something completely different, and that related to the material in the book about how she said that she'd actually seen some of these bodies and said that the whole alien angle was a cover to hide these fairly controversial human experiments, which weren't just the Roswell crash, but actually high altitude experiments, high altitude exposure experiments using people as well. And so this was interesting for several reasons. One, because she was able to verify her employment at Oak Ridge, and secondly, it kind of tied in with what this other guy had told me 5 years previously back in England. And so from there, she put me in touch indirectly in a couple of cases with several other people that knew the inside on this particular story. And what happened was that the name she gave me, one of them initially was quite open to speaking to me, two of the others she inadvertently revealed enough details that allowed me to get on their trail, so to speak. And in one, I guess, interesting and amusing exchange, when I first tracked down one of the other people, he denied being the person who he was. He said, "No, you've got the right name, but I'm the wrong person." And when I was able to present documents showing that his social security number in the 50s matched his social security number of today, then, you know, he couldn't deny it any longer. And it was a case of, well, you know, well, who are you? Why are you looking for me? And then I explained the situation. And if you look at the back of the book, if people have read the book, they'll note that the interview I did with a lady from Oak Ridge was in the summer of 2001, and then the rest of the interviews were either at the end of 2003 or into 2004. And the reason why there was this 18-month gap between the summer of 2001 and the end of 2003 was because in that period I literally could not get these people to speak on the record, and it was only after a lot of hassling and...
Yeah, I understand.
Ensuring, you know, their privacy. Mm-hmm. One of the things I would stress is that although a couple of the people in the book declined to be named, obviously with the book being published by a publisher the size of Simon & Schuster, and with them having their legal departments, I had to provide all the background information and full names and testimony and everything else to the legal office. It wasn't the case, you know, that they were just prepared to go with anonymous sources. I had to demonstrate to the legal departments who these people were and provide all the necessary background. It's just that, unfortunately, some of that doesn't appear in the book, but it is on file with the legal attorneys at Simon & Schuster.
You know, Nick, I've run across you a couple of times at conferences. We've never really had a chance to do a show together until now, and I have always followed your career very interestingly. A lot of your comrades in arms speak highly of you. Many of them are shocked about this particular book, however.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can understand that. I mean, you know, I think the misconception has been that, you know, I'm full on for the extraterrestrial theory. My stance and approach with the UFO subject has always been to go where the evidence suggests. And I'll be the first to admit that I previously did think that, you know, the best argument was that a UFO did crash at Roswell. I thought that best fitted the evidence for the material evidence and the bodies particularly. You know, what else could these bodies have been? But I've always taken the approach that, you know, we shouldn't investigate these things from a belief system. We should investigate them from an evidence system.
Well, yeah, I understand that. I've been doing these shows.
Just another angle, even if it may not be the angle that we want to hear.
You know, I'm kind of agnostic on the subject, even though I've been doing shows about it for 40 years. That's my point, and you kind of explained it. You're not really a debunker as such.
No, I mean, you know, the scenario I'm presenting isn't one of just, you know, a straightforward down-to-earth balloon setup in the way that the government's talking about. It's arguably, in many ways, more controversial than if aliens crashed, you know, actually exploiting people brought over from another country in classified aerial experiments.
What kind of fallout are you getting from this book? It's been out for a few weeks now.
It's kind of exactly what I expected. There are some people who think that what I've uncovered is the absolute truth. There are some people who think that the people have got fragments of the story, but they may not know the whole thing. And there are other people who think it's a government disinformation to further hide, you know, the UFO story and confuse it even further.
You have been investigating other ET stories and extraterrestrial stories and UFO stories. What is your take on all that? Do you think it's possible?
Sure. But I mean, I'll be the first to admit, and I always have been, and I'm keen to stress this, that it's not impossible that I was fed disinformation to hide the UFO story even further. But the argument I have against that is that there are two points. One is that, you know, or actually the three points. One is that at the time, I wasn't investigating Roswell. These people approached me. So it wasn't like I was on the Roswell trail and had to be diverted. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like someone like Stan Friedman, who was digging deep into it, there might be a need or an attempt to divert him away. That didn't happen with me because I just wasn't... If these people hadn't approached me, I wouldn't have looked into the story. And the other reason, or the two other reasons, one is that, you know, as far as the theory is concerned, in many ways it's more controversial than the UFO thing.
Yeah, and the extraterrestrial, right.
Yeah, and so inevitably, whether people believe it or not, that is going to draw more attention to it rather than take attention away. And thirdly, the government already has the crash test dummy and the Mogul balloon explanation still in place, which they still support. So, for me, it would seem that to introduce yet another cover story would only not just confuse things more, but make people even more suspicious if the government said, well, no, it wasn't a Mogul balloon or crash test dummies, but it was actually a Japanese experiment.
In all your investigations, have you run across an ET incident that you believe the evidence really shows it might be extraterrestrial?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is one of the things that I want to stress to people is that I haven't changed actually my views on the UFO subject per se. What I've changed my view on is whether or not an alien spacecraft crashed at Roswell. And ironically, the reason why I became interested in this particular subject is my father used to work in the British Royal Air Force, and he worked on radar. He was actually involved in several incidents in the early 1950s where fast-moving UFOs, for want of a better term, were tracked on the radar scopes over the English Channel and the English North Sea. And these are travelling at fantastic speeds and doing quite literally left and right-hand turns to evade the aircraft that had been sent up to intercept these things. And it was quite clear almost immediately that this wasn't the work of the Russians or anybody like that, that this was genuinely strange. And my dad still remembers that to this day. He still talks about it. So, you know, it's incidents like this where you have trained observers that convince me that there is a real UFO mystery. But I think, ironically, the fact that there is a real UFO mystery acts as a good cover for people when they want to hide things like the Roswell story. You know, the fact that there really are weird things out there reinforces the idea that maybe one of these things crashed.
You think any government anywhere in the world has an extraterrestrial?
I mean, that could be one of, again, a lot of irony to this story. That could be one of the ironic things. You know, the Roswell incident is just one incident among quite literally thousands of UFO reports. You know, just because something may have crashed at Roswell that wasn't extraterrestrial, if there really are UFOs up there as well, it could be. You know, we have a whole range of things going on with human-built UFOs, with alien-built UFOs, and, you know, there's a clash, you know, in kind of a grey area where we don't know exactly which falls into one category and which falls into another.
Yeah, you got a good point there. We only have about 5 minutes left. You mentioned your dad was in the British Air Force. Are you from England or Australia?
I'm originally from England, but my wife's from Beaumont, Texas, and we live in Dallas.
Yeah, I knew that. The part that somebody was trying to tell me, no, you're not English, you're Australian. And I said, no, I think he's English. Yeah. So you live in Texas, and you travel quite a lot. one of these things that I immediately thought about when you wrote this book was how is this going to affect your ability to attend and lecture at UFO conferences?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Affect my attempt to attend?
Well, of course not. They'll let you in. They'll let me in.
I don't think they'll actually bar me at the door. I mean, this is one of the things people said. Well, you know, you've obviously been misinformed, or you're just doing it.
Oh well, yeah. You know, many times when people come out with a controversial theory, they'll say, "Why, you know, he's making that up." Now, no one said that about you. Everyone is very careful to say, Nick Redfern's a very good researcher and a very good reporter, which I understand you are.
No, I would never. I mean, I would never make anything like that up. But I do accept that some people think that I've been misinformed. But, you know, if anybody ever did come along and say, oh, you know, we just think you made it up, the thing I would stress is that, you know, I spend a lot of time lecturing at UFO conferences, writing for UFO magazines, and I can tell everybody categorically and without doubt that it does me no favors whatsoever to put this book out.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
I do have a high regard for the search for the truth, and so...
Well, hopefully it won't affect even your lectures, but...
But if it does, I mean, the thing I want to stress is that, as I said, you know, putting this book out, there's no incentive for me to do that, in actual fact.
It would be the other way around.
Said to me, they said, I actually had one email where the person said, to hell with you, I'm never booking you to speak for me again, which, to me, you know, it didn't actually bother me, because, you know, it just amazed me and made me laugh more than anything else that somebody... would say that.
Oh, we get all kinds of reactions ourselves. The
important point is that, you know, writing a book that makes me unpopular with the UFO subject doesn't do me any favors. And the only motivation was that the story seemed to hang together, the witnesses were credible, they were able to provide documentation, confirming that they were who they claimed to be, at least, regardless of the story. And so I went with it because I felt it was worth looking into. And so... that's why I put the story out, but, you know, I am the first to admit that, you know, doing so doesn't help my position.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm actually working on another book now, which is, again, on UFOs, but not so much on UFO encounters, but it's the way in which the government, for the last 50 years, has monitored UFO researchers. So it's basically official surveillance of the UFO research community and how and why certain key players in the subject have been watched by the intelligence community.
That'll be an interesting book. Did your name come up?
No, actually it did. A number of people whose names you would expect to see in there, and some who you wouldn't expect to see in there, and some of the ones who you wouldn't expect to see was because the surveillance was done not so much because of their UFO research, but because some of these people had more political interests as well, and the intelligence community feared the fact that the UFO research was a cover for other activities as well.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So there's kind of like a cross-section of why different people were monitored, going back to the 40s to the present.
Yeah. We'll maybe run across you at another UFO conference. We don't know. But for sure, we'll talk to you when the next book comes out. Well, you know, we've been doing this just for 40 years, and I started out very naive. I just wanted to hear stories about something landing and somebody getting out and saying hello. Over the years, I found that there is a little bit of infighting in the UFO community, unfortunately. But I guess there always is in every field. And academia is the worst. Nick, I've enjoyed it.
All right, Jerry. Appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, bye-bye.